So what we're exploring in this really is the whole idea of fairy, she, contact with fairies. So this ballad of Tamlin that we've been looking at a little, Tamlin is himself an otherworldly figure. So in the beginning of the ballad, there's this figure of Tamlin who appears at a magical well. And the big ballad begins by saying, if you go down to Carter Hall where the well is, Tamlin will either take your ring from you or else your maidenhead. So here's this kind of magical kind of figure who appears and either steals money or takes sexual advantage of any women who go there. And then what we have is the remarkable and wonderful figure of Janet, who likes the idea of having sex with a fairy. and so hearing this story, she romps down there and is a bit disappointed because she finds his horse, and since she finds his horse, but away is himself, he's not there. And she plucks the red rose of desire, which summons him. And then, kind of, ballad doesn't tell us what actually happens. We assume they have sex, because the next thing we know in the ballad is she's pregnant. And he's talking about morning sickness because she's as green as any grass in the morning. And then there's a whole kind of thing about the king kind of feeling dear Janet, I fear you go a child. And then there's this great proclamation from Janet, not any knight of yours shall give my child his name. She claims her own independent femininity, her own sovereignty over her own child. And she goes back to the Carter Hall, and then she threatens to pluck something called the scathing herb, which is a herb that would abort the child. And in a sense, having laid hold of the energies of life, she then reaches for the energies of death, which summon the presence of Tamlin again. And he says, "What you do not, lady, do not touch his herb. Do not kill the bonny babe we have got us between." And then, because she's in a sense threatens him, he tells her the story of how he was stolen from by the fairy queen. And that every 10 years they have to pause the 7 years, however long it is anyway, they have to pay a tithe to hell, and he fears the fairies are about to offer him up to the devil and to hell to pay their tithe. And you can see at this point how the Christian imagery and the older pagan imagery have kind of come together. And then she said, but he says she can save him if on Samhain night, last night, Friday night rather, she goes to Miles Cross, a crossroads place, which is a liminal place, and if she lets pass the grey and the brown, and grabs the rider on the milk white steed, whom she will know by, because he will have a gold star in his crown, because he's a human being, and that's the gold star that is the sort of the pentagram image, that is like the Vitruvius image. It's the image of the human being with the four qualities and the fifth. And then she drags him down from the horse, and then she envelops him in her mantle. And then he's changed into all kinds of things, into bear, into lion, into a nest of vipers, into burning lead.
So she is, or he is?
He is. So she's holding him while this happens. And eventually he becomes a naked knight, sheltered by her green gown. Now and it's ambiguous at this point whether or not he is her lover or whether he is her child. So is he in the room? Is he her lover she's embracing? Is this the fusion of opposites, or is it the mother and the son? So it's a mystery really at this point. And the story ends, the ballad ends with the fairy queen cursing them both out of a bush of broom, out of a burning bush. Now you've got to, one of the interesting things about these ballads is, of course, they're written in kind of thoroughly Christianized times. So the voice that comes out of the burning bush is the voice that speaks to Moses and tells them that my name is I am that I am. So here we have this subversion, if you like, of the Christian tradition, where it's the fairy queen speaking a malediction out of that. And the completion, really, of the story of Tamlin, we find in the story of Thomas Rymer. They're both from the same area. So it's in a certain sense, if we think that the Tamlin ballad is all about really the earthing, the grounding, the bringing of the energy out of fairyland, the freeing of the prisoners, of those that get lost in fairy. The next ballad doesn't have any of that antagonism in it. We have Thomas the Rhymer sleeping under the Eildon tree, under the hawthorn tree, which is one of the classic entrances to fairyland. And we have this the fairy queen riding with 7 silver bells and 9 upon her horse. And so she finds Thomas asleep under the tree. He wakes up and he thinks she's Mary, the Queen of Heaven. And she says, "No, don't give me that name, but I am the Queen of Elfland." And you've got this juxtaposition of Mary and the Elfland Queen, and are they the same? Are they not? Not sure. But he willingly goes with her. And then they ride, really, through the into fairyland, through rivers of tears, through rivers of blood. And they come to a place where there is an apple tree, which will remind us of the story of the Garden of Eden. And he sees an apple on the tree, which he's going to pluck to give to her. And she says to him, "No, you must not pluck that apple, for in it are all the plagues that are in hell are in that apple." But because, in a sense, he's offered it to her, not trying to grab it for himself, she's able to protect him from that. And then there's a transition where suddenly, because of his offering to her, they're then sitting underneath the apple tree, and she gives him the bread and wine, which in a certain sense she administers the Eucharist to him. So you have this profoundly kind of heretical, unusual idea of the Queen of Fairy standing in the place of Christ and giving the bread and wine to Thomas. And as a result of that, he then sees a choice of three ways. There's a hill in front of them, and there's the broad way of wickedness that some say leads to heaven. So there's a big broad way, which would be the, in some ways, from our understanding, the way of consumerism, glory, power. There's a narrow road of righteousness beset by thorns and briars. And then there's this third road, which winds around the Ferny Brae. Ferny Brae is the stream, and it's bordered by ferns, which are the kind of fractal kind of plant. And that is the way that goes over the hill into fair Elfland. And he chooses to go over the hill into the place of mystery, following the queen. We never know what happens to him over the hill, but he comes back trance. So 7 long years, as weal as woe may chance to be, in goodness and in sorrow, he is in the service of the Queen of Fairy. And then he comes back from the world of fairy, wearing the green colour that is the colour of a fairy, wearing the green shoes, which means he's the traveller who can walk between the fairy realm and the human realm, and possessing the tongue that cannot lie, the prophetic ability that sees through to the heart of everything. And so so taken together, the two ballads give us one, that sense of the antagonistic place and the way you deal with, if you like, the sense of being imprisoned in fairy. But then the deeper work really is that work of kind of connection and love and union with the fairy beings that enables something else to happen. Yeah.
First one, he's not freed, is he? Something goes wrong.
Well, no, in the sense that he comes out of fairy, no. He does. No, she brings him out of fairy, right? So she, and she ends up embracing him, but you're left with the curse of the fairy queen hovering over them both. So she sends, so it ends with, I wish I'd rip it out your heart of flesh and put in a heart of stone. If I'd have known of thee, Tamlin, some lady'd borrowed thee, I'd rip it out thine eyes of flesh and put in eyes from a tree, she says. So she's kind of, so she would have made him into an object, an insensate thing somewhere. And so she's unreconciled. And the very fact that she's speaking out of the burning bush to, really means that there's this unreconciled divine figure, angry goddess figure in the background. Yeah,
she a bit Caridwen-like.
She's well, in that place where Caridwen is pursuing Taliesin, and in that enraged place, yes, I guess that's so. Really, yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking of another one where she has to throw something and look at something behind, and she doesn't throw it.
No, that's a different. That's, I don't know what that is, but that's a difference to, different from the Ballad of Tamlin. That's a different thing.
So, have you any comments on the fact that traditionally, maybe, I don't know, there's meant to be a Seelie and an Unseelie court, which is the Unseelie court is fairies who are actually antagonistic towards human beings. And I think this is in John Matthews, I don't
know. Yes, that's right. Funny enough, Robin and I were talking about John's work the other day. There's a. You don't really find that in the older traditions, really. There's a whole tradition of writing that's, which makes for an exciting story about the wicked fairies and the good fairies, and yeah. And it goes back, in a sense of fairy godmothers and bard, and the bard fairy who turns up, really, and sort of. And I think there is an obvious thing about when we're dealing with inner beings, some are less approachable than others.
Yeah.
And there's a whole process of the resonance of the heart. Some we can resonate with, some we should not approach, some we can be harmed by, not because they're meaning us harm, but because they're just so different to us and their energies don't match with our own. But there's a whole literature has grown up, particularly in during our lifetime, about the Seelie court, which was the good fairies, and the Unseelie, which are the bard fairies. And while I think it makes for a nice story, I'm not sure it's very useful.
It's about a basic crisis antagonism situation, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But I mean, exactly the same thing. It's true when you're contacting trees.
Yeah.
Some want to be left alone. Some are very friendly.
And interestingly, I think, to come back to Tolkien for a minute, really, when you look at Tolkien, if you look at Tolkien's story, some of the elves are very kindly disposed to people, others are not. Some of the trees are very kindly, other trees try to kill human beings.
Yeah.
It's really about entering into an universe of continual conversations, where sometimes there is resonance and confluence and conversation, other times there's antagonism and difficulty, and we have to be prepared for that as well, really.
Yeah.
And it's usually,
well,
sometimes it's because of what humans have done. Oh, no, of course. Recognizing
all humans. Yeah. No, very often it is that, but also sometimes it's just about the different nature of the inner beings, really, and the fact that they'll always understand the particularity of human existence. So that's also a feature of these things.
Humans.
No.
Humans.
But they become humanized as we kind of. One of the things about working with inner beings of whatever kind, whether they're god figures or she or whatever we work with, or elementals, what happens is as we come into relationship with them, we learn more about them, they learn more about us. Mm. And we come into a kind of a living relationship.
It's like a Venn diagram, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's humans and fairy, and there's an overlap where both are slightly, not necessarily changed, but subtly influenced to make a conversation.
Yeah, possible. That's right. Yeah, exactly.
I know Caitlin always says as we have these conversations, we become more real to them. That's they become more real to us. we become more real to them. We thicken up, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of being ghost presences, we become more real.
Yeah, and they likewise do that to us. So they become part of our life, we become part of their lives, really. Yeah. Okay.